spoofing MAC addresses and making headphones. A big week for Apple. The NSA balks at preserving data for trial. What happens when security camera footage goes viral? And an update this week from Bloomberg on the status of key issues in the continuing saga of data protection revisions in Europe. That's not all, but it's a start. Welcome back to 40ANM in 5, the weekly download of 40ANM LLC. It's Monday, June 16th, and I'm Chris Bohm. First up, it has been a week of buzz for Apple, in more ways than one. Last week, we talked about Apple's planned purchase of Beats, the music streaming and headphone manufacturing firm, for roughly $3 billion. This week, we learned a bit more regarding why this purchase may have made more strategic sense than the obvious boon to Apple's fledgling attempts at developing a music streaming following. Many have commented this past week on the potential that Apple might one day be considering to do away with the standard 3.5mm headphone connector on its iPhones and other devices, putting all of its audio eggs, so to speak, in one basket, the proprietary Apple Lightning port connection. The 3.5mm headphone jack is ubiquitous, and it's been the audio plug-in standard since the Sony Walkman was debuted in the early 1980s. Small, sturdy, and requiring no special power in its connected devices, 3.5mm plug also would not facilitate the type of functionality that could be embedded in a headset like the Lightning port. From voice-activated communication via your headphones to remote adjustment and perhaps even slightly better high-end audio processing, Apple could make some selling points of a move to a Lightning port-only connection, including the fact that the port itself could be used to power the headphone device. But that also highlights a potential issue for Apple users, as a Lightning port-connected headset, once the 3.5mm jack is removed, would largely prevent users from listening to a device while it's charging, as the headphones would now need the Lightning port. In any event, even if Apple considers a rollout of a higher-end headphone using the Lightning port, which it probably will do, perhaps for the wave of iPhone 6 releases, it is unlikely that they would also do away rapidly with the 3.5mm headphone jack as well, perhaps saving its removal entirely for a later release of devices. On another side of the device spectrum this past week, Apple announced that its iOS version 8 will be implementing protections for users to prevent them from being spied on by retailers and hackers as their handsets search for Wi-Fi portals. Users of the new iOS 8 will no longer have their MAC address or Media Access Control address, a unique identifier that every mobile device has, which has traditionally let networks know the device is nearby and ready to connect. Some retailers have been using the fact that the devices readily advertise MAC addresses for purposes of connection in order to track customers as they move through stores. Because the MAC address shows up at different Wi-Fi ports, triangulation between a number of these ports in a retailer's location can show where the phone owner is and what is of interest to the shopper. With the new iOS 8, the devices will be broadcasting fake MAC addresses, only revealing the real device MAC address once the user decides to connect to a given Wi-Fi portal. Retailers can also choose to track consumers via Bluetooth if the Apple user has engaged the device's iBeacon feature, but use of the iBeacon requires a user to first opt in. Vodafone, the second largest mobile phone provider in the world, took the unprecedented step this past week of releasing a lengthy report on the voice, internet, and other data collections requested of it by law enforcement authorities globally. Vodafone's networks cover parts of Asia and Africa, as well as most of Europe. Until Verizon had purchased the remaining share held by Vodafone and Verizon Wireless just last year, Vodafone had been a key stakeholder in that company as well. The upshot of the Vodafone report's summary and over 88-page detailed attachment is that the type of access to communication networks now known to occur under the auspices of the NSA in the U.S. also occurs in other countries where legal protections are almost certainly lower, as a general matter. Although the company did not name the small number of countries in which internet and other data could be collected without any court review, the Washington Post's Craig Timberg reported that anecdotal information suggests that at least one of these countries is Great Britain, where its GCHQ intelligence agency is a close partner of the NSA in filtering the world's internet traffic. Among the 29 nations that have made millions of data requests of Vodafone are several countries, including South Africa, Turkey, Egypt, and several others, where publishing even rudimentary totals of access requests are prohibited by law. The report also discussed several instances where governments have what is called direct access, permitting intercepted communications without a court order or even making a formal request of the company. In the report, Vodafone details why it believes that such types of direct access must end. While the Vodafone report does distinguish between two types of content, words and other information on the one hand, and metadata on the other, the bits of data that reveal who contacted whom, when and for how long and in what manner, it makes little distinction when it comes to pressures exerted on the company by governments requiring access, whether it be potential removal of a license to operate in the country, possible criminal sanctions on employees, or imprisonment for refusing to comply. U.S.-based tech companies, including Microsoft, Yahoo, and Facebook, have adopted new encryption measures, as well as demanding greater freedom for transparency, to report on surveillance requests made, as well as lobbying fervently for curbs on surveillance. Verizon listed 320,000 surveillance requests in the U.S. and among 11 other countries in 2013, according to the Washington Post, with AT&T listing more than 300,000 similar requests. Bloomberg's BNA and Stephen Gardner had a bit of a scoop this past Monday when Bloomberg reported that the EU and U.S. were ever more closer to concluding a long-desired data transfer pact for law enforcement purposes. The U.S. and EU had begun talks toward a potential umbrella agreement to govern data exchanges for law enforcement purposes way back in 2011. But it was only after revelations began from the leaks made by former NSA contractor Edward Snowden did the talks get kick-started into higher gear. And by this past midwinter, both sides were beginning to signal that a potential agreement might be reached by summer. As reported by BNA this past week, European Commission Vice President and Commissioner for Justice Viviane Reding told reporters that, for law enforcement-related transfers, 95% of what could be agreed has been agreed. Her comments came at the close of the June 6th meeting between justice ministers from the 28 EU member states, which had been called to discuss the pending draft data protection regulation. As we discussed last week, one of the key outcomes of that meeting, or at least what many had hoped would be a key outcome, was an agreement on one-stop shop, an approach to data protection complaints whereby a complaint would be handled by the data protection authority in the country in which the company has its main establishment, or perhaps in partnership with the data protection authority of the country of the complainant. There was no agreement coming out of the June 6th sessions, and from all indications, according to Bloomberg, this is an issue that will likely wait until Italy takes over the presidency of the EU Council following Greece's departure on June 30th. Meanwhile, BNA reported on Commissioner Reding's comments that the U.S. Department of Commerce has agreed to 12 out of the 13 requirements made of the U.S. by the EU for possible continuance and reinforcement of the Safe Harbor Agreement. The requirements cover such issues as transparency, redress, enforcement, and access by U.S. authorities, although in a sign that there has been some give and take between the parties, BNA reports that EU citizens' redress of issues relating to data transferred under the Safe Harbor will likely occur under the auspices of alternative dispute mechanisms rather than access to the courts. The point of contention, according to BNA, is on the issue of when an exception under the Safe Harbor program would permit U.S. national security bodies to access data covered by the Safe Harbor program. On this issue, according to BNA, Commissioner Reding wants to ensure that the exception remains exceptional, in her words, and that it shouldn't allow U.S. officials simply to vacuum up data. The Washington Post's Andrea Peterson reported this past week on arguments by the NSA that for it to preserve all of the data acquired by it under Section 702 of the Amendments to the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act would present significant operational problems. U.S. District Court Judge Jeffrey White of the Northern District of California had issued an emergency order just a week ago barring the government from destroying data that the Electronic Frontier Foundation had asked be preserved for the case of Juul v. NSA. Although the Juul case predated the first Snowden revelations that began on June 5, 2013, it is one of many lawsuits filed over NSA surveillance programs, many of them launched in the wake of the first NSA surveillance revelations. The EFF wanted to access the database of NSA-collected material primarily to scrutinize it for purposes of the trial, but the NSA argued that the communications collected actually reside in multiple databases contained on multiple systems, presenting significant obstacles to holding and searching the data over time and for purposes of trial. As reported by the Post, the EFF's legal director, Cindy Cohn, commented that the situation demonstrates that once the government has custody of this information, even they can't keep track of it anymore, even for purposes of what they don't want to destroy. As reported by the Post, the request to preserve data for purposes of trial puts the EFF in an odd predicament of asking the government to retain data that the organization would ultimately like to see destroyed. The request by the EFF had, according to the Post, come about in part by accident, when an email exchange with a Justice Department attorney the week before had revealed that the government was looking into whether it could preserve data collected under Section 702, even after the NSA had long ago, as early as 2009, been ordered to do so. We reported last week on several initiatives at work in Washington and elsewhere in the U.S., to track legislative efforts aimed at addressing what has become known as revenge porn. Imagine browsing the internet and finding that an ex-partner had posted sexually explicit images of you online without your consent, perhaps to get back at you for ending the relationship. But what if the images aren't revenge porn or nearly as salacious, but something as seemingly innocuous as security camera footage? And what if the release of those images and the reasons for which they're suddenly made public has nothing to do with a spurned partner? Some cases, particularly in the U.S., have served to illustrate that the portability and prevalence of digital images can prove vexing from a policy and compliance perspective as well, apart from the clear legal concerns attendant to hacking and other crimes. Take, for instance, the recent high-profile case of a leaked elevator video from a New York hotel that, once acquired by the website TMZ, was shown to allegedly depict an altercation between a rap star and another singer's sister. According to NBC News' Julianne Pepitone, the hotel issued an email stating that they were shocked and disappointed that there was a clear breach of their security system and the confidentiality that they count on providing their guests. Ms. Pepitone's NBC News piece, published on their website in late May, highlights that businesses will typically hold security camera hard drive backups separately from security booth viewing areas, and typically retain those for about 60 days, although each state requires different storage periods for insurance purposes. The experts consulted by NBC for the article cited that each security camera setup should be seen much like a laptop, in that whoever accesses the system to access the footage will leave a login credential stamp. However, security companies who provide system services can also often log into camera systems, as often can staffers at system manufacturers. If a system is remotely accessed, whether that access and what was copied amounts to a Computer Fraud and Abuse Act violation will likely depend on the facts and restrictions, if any, that were placed on the access. This is unlike the case, for instance, in the Central District of California in 2013, where a 27-year-old hacked into the laptop of a beauty pageant winner, extracted images, and then used these in an attempt to extort money from the victim. The perpetrator, a Jared Abrahams, pleaded guilty to one count of computer hacking under the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act and three counts of extortion. The Computer Fraud and Abuse Act, passed originally in 1984, provides not only criminal penalties for the unauthorized access of a device or account, but in 1994 a provision was added to permit civil action damages. Under the statute, the notion of what is an unauthorized access is particularly broad, and in addition, court cases such as the Ninth Circuit's 2000 decision in U.S. v. Middleton, the statute requires little in terms of loss to be shown in order to activate the law's remedies. Access and misuse of digital media in cases like the one highlighted by NBC is a security and compliance nightmare for certain, but the NBC article highlights that even if a system is not sophisticated enough to show what a user might be doing with footage, and some will show if a clip is exported, most will at least show who logged in and when they were active. So, how do most of us get our fix for regular economic data? By now, for some of you, eyes may have glazed over at the thought. For most of us, even those who consider themselves economically aware, we can wait until the Federal Reserve's biannual monetary policy report to Congress. Fed Chair Janet Yellen gave what was for her the first of these reports back in February to the Senate Banking and House Financial Services Committees, a printed report and set of testimonies sometimes referred to as the biannual State of the Economy reports. Originally implemented in the 1970s under the Humphrey-Hawkins Full Employment and Balanced Growth Act, Ms. Yellen will give another report in July, and the Senate and House committees, which will, per tradition, swap places as to who gets to receive her testimony first. Or if you're really itching for data, from various regions and sources, you can get your hands on a beige book, so-called because it was once available only in print, 8 times yearly, with a beige-colored cardboard cover, a cover that belied the critical nature of the data from each of the Federal Reserve districts reported on inside. Each Federal Reserve Bank gathers anecdotal information on the current economic conditions in its district through reports from bank and branch directors and interviews with key business contacts, economists, market experts, and others. With information summarized by federal district and industry sector, one Federal Reserve Bank gets the task, on a rotating basis, to summarize the data for all in each report. The last beige book came out on June 4th, and the next, in the now 8-volume series for 2014, will get issued on July 16th. If you want to avoid the beige cover, it's now available online, of course. But of course, we'd be remiss if we didn't also highlight that once a quarter, the Fed Chair and her colleagues in the Federal Open Market Committee review the state of the economy and project where they think it might be going, predictions as to unemployment, inflation, growth, and interest rates. The next batch of predictions will be discussed by Chairwoman Yellen on June 18th. But all of this background is, of course, leading up to something new. For the Hutchins Center on Fiscal and Monetary Policy at the Brookings Institution, they are launching something they're calling Janet Yellen's Dashboard, an online compendium of the dozen most important measures of economic vigor that the Fed Chair looks to steer the economy toward the Fed's statutory goals of maximum sustainable employment and price stability. With a snappy graphic of the Fed Chair looking at an actual dashboard, made up of many dials full of measures of data available, Brookings will chart such bellwether data as the Personal Consumption Expenditure Price Index, as well as the trend in average hourly wages, and the bond market's expectations for future inflation. If you ever had an interest in macroeconomic policy and the data drivers behind it, I'd encourage you to take a look at the Brookings Institution's new initiative. Sure, at present, it's a beta initiative, but it's smart, functional. The dashboard graphic and the concept are helpfully kitschy, and most importantly, it makes an important data-driven component of these key financial policy issues just a little bit more accessible, and that is a very good thing. The Janet Yellen's Dashboard can be found at www.brookings.edu/research/interactives/2014/Janet Yellen's Dashboard. For the past several weeks, I've been receiving emails from a company touting its cloud-based storage services and offering me, free of charge, a certain minimal amount of storage on their servers, presumably with the hope that I'll like what they have to offer and want more. The emails I received touted a connection with my business hosting provider, perhaps one that was developed for marketing purposes. This happens all the time, of course. We are marketed on the basis of our original connections with service providers, for services or products that may in some way be related. We sometimes ignore them, or we often say yes or no to an offer. And we frequently will send an email or make a choice simply to unsubscribe. Don't bother me anymore. I mentioned this casually to a colleague the other day and the notion that I'd likely choose to unsubscribe from the list, having already done a quick search to determine that it was indeed a legitimate, though startup company, offering me the services from a home base in the UK. Her reply was, "Wouldn't I be wary of seeming hostile to cloud services, given my abrupt unsubscribe?" As I already use cloud-based services in my daily work and fun, I regarded her response as silly, and that was how she meant it. But it did get me thinking. What do users think of first when deciding whether to choose such offers or even inquire for more information? If I'm inclined to take the time, the first thing I do with most of these inquiries, once I've determined that the company itself is at least legitimate, is to see what happens when I choose unsubscribe from the base of the email. How a company handles ending a relationship, even if it's just a marketing prospect, will tell you a lot about the company's culture, how it will treat issues of privacy and confidentiality. Particularly in the present environment, where cloud and so many other online service providers are cultivating or recultivating trust. How a company executes on the basics will be telling. In this case, when I chose unsubscribe and was linked to a website, not only wasn't there a choice to quickly remove myself from the list, but the site required me to set up an account to go further, even to execute the simple unsubscribe I was looking to actualize. In the end, I chose simply to go old school and reply to their email with an unsubscribe in the header and the body of the email. Depending upon how they handled the unsubscribe, if they had given me a thank you for your time and very quick way off the list, or perhaps included an option to say why I was not interested, it might actually have given me the impetus to find out more about them. Why? Because how professionally they handled the prospect of perhaps ending their contact with me, the very basics of privacy and opt-out, would tell me much about how serious they might eventually be with me on the privacy basics as a customer. You have been listening to 40ANM in 5. For more information and for our terms of use, visit 40a-m.com. All stories for this week's download were reported by at least two online or print news sources, or taken directly from relevant releases, with the exception of specific reporting highlighted from NBC News, Bloomberg BNA, the Brookings Institution, and the Washington Post. Thank you for listening. 40ANM in 5 will be off for the next 2 weeks, returning again on Tuesday, July 8th. Until then, of course, make this week and every week one to remember. And bye for now.